Hi, and welcome to another episode of Lorenzo's Music Podcast, a show where I talk to musicians that I've met online or musicians that I've played on our music show itself because I liked their music. And then I'm like, well, maybe I can meet them and talk to them about what they do. And this one is from the Creative Commons Music Podcast that I do because, like us, they're Creative Commons musicians. And the person I talked to today is based in France, which is funny because here I had to do the interview during the day, and over there it's like, you know, 10 at night and they're having a glass of wine and it's dark. And so you'll see that if you're watching the video, you'll see that there's definitely a time difference, and you know, they're able to kick back and drink some wine and talk with me. But it's a great talk. They tour all the time. They talk about how they remixed a bunch of songs from their album. They put out a call out for remixes, and the label Block Sonic that they're on actually had a bunch of musicians make remixes of the song, and they have a new album coming out. They tour constantly. It's a great band, a fun anarchist pop punk band, Lewis Ling and the Bombs. So here's the interview starting right now.
Hi, my name's Josh, and I'm a singer in a punk rock band and a music producer.
Yeah. So you're in Lewis Ling and the Bombs, and I've known you for a while. I've known about your music for a while. Basically, what's been going on? You guys have been releasing stuff and playing out. Tell me about, first of all, for everybody listening, where are you located?
We're based in Paris, in France. I'm British.
That's right. Yeah, no, you are British, but you're based in France. How did you get to France again? So why are you in France?
It was quite random, actually.
Yeah.
Like one day my French girlfriend at the time, she said, we're moving to France because you promised me that one year ago, you said that you would move to France in 1 year. And I said that? Really? I'm a man of my word. So I moved to France, even though I swear she lied. I never agreed to this.
Right. She just like basically goes, I want to move to France. I know. He won't remember. I'll tell him that he told me we would.
I had no memory of that at all. In fact, actually, I didn't even realize that she was going to move to England. There was a knock at the door, and there she was, and then just on the pavement was her car full of her stuff.
Wait, you knew each other at least beforehand, correct?
Yeah, but she was like, "Remember, you invited me to live with you," and I was like, "Oh shit, I'd totally forgotten about that." Damn.
How long ago was this?
That was a long time ago, when I was in the 90s, when I lived in Liverpool.
Okay.
And so I kind of shouted to my landlord. I said, "Alex, is it okay if Agnes comes and lives with us?" And he was like, yeah, it's fine. And then we started unloading her stuff, and I was, oh, damn. I didn't really even like her very much, to be honest. And it was start of a terrible thing, and I ended up in France, and so that's good. I like this country.
Were you playing music when you were in England, or when did you start playing music?
Yeah, in Liverpool, I was in a digital hardcore band called Dummy Crusher.
Called what?
Dummy Crusher, crushing the dummies.
Nice.
Digital hardcore was all the rage in the 90s, so that was cool.
What do you do in a digital hardcore band? I guess I can picture what the music would sound like, but I'm trying to picture what you do.
I was standing there with a guitar looking cool.
Okay.
But we had one guy with like a record, and his record was just like noise. And then we had one guy with a sampler, and all of the samples were just noise. And then we had one guy with a synthesizer, and he kind of made some kind of noise. And then we had a backing track actually playing the actual songs with the beats and everything.
So you guys made noise, and then you had a backing track that basically created the song.
Yeah.
So the backing track was doing all the work, is what you're saying.
the backing track was doing all the work, and we were just like making it hard for the audience to even hear the backing track by just making noise.
Okay.
It was a concept.
So how did that eventually turn into Lewis Ling and the Bombs?
Well, when I moved to France, I started playing in like French music cover bands because I thought it'd be nice to like learn about French music. And I decided I didn't really like that. And then I played in a couple of French punk bands. I played keyboards in a punk band. And then I played, I played keyboards in two punk bands, actually. And then I started producing rock bands, actually, like, quite seriously. I quite started producing bands. And it's a good story, actually.
Yeah, no, I was just going to say, how did you start producing rock bands? I mean, what made you take that transition?
Because in Paris, it's not like any city in America. It's like I would go out at night in Paris and see these bands, and most French bands sucked, but like some of them were amazing.
Okay.
Amazing. And eventually I found the best French band in all of France at that specific time. They were called Underground Railroad. And I went to talk to them and I said, look, I want to make a record for you guys. Has anybody, but I guess you already have a label and people. And they were like, no, you're the first person to speak to us.
Really?
I couldn't believe it. You know, you go to like any American city, you're from Madison, you go to Madison mm-hmm. and you see a band that's like as good as Nirvana. And you go to talk to them after the show. And you say, I want to make a record with you. And they go, yeah, sure, because no one else is talking to us. It's amazing. But so that's really cool.
Just as to your analogy there, Nirvana did record Nevermind in Madison. So this is where the album was made.
Holy shit. That's awesome.
So yeah, Smart Studios is where they did it.
So I did that and I made a demo for this band for a record label called Polygram.
Did you wait you for Polygram Records?
Yeah.
Oh, you bastard. Yeah. Okay, hold on a second.
So I made, but it gets better because I made the record for Polygram, yeah. And I gave it to Polygram.
Okay.
They then called me. They said they loved it.
Mm-hmm.
They said it's amazing. We love it. And so I invited them to a concert of Underground Railroad. So we were really cooking. And the record people, they went there and they said, and they watched the concert and they said, yeah, it was a good concert, but where was the songs on the demo? And I was like, what do you mean?
Yeah.
And I said, where are the songs on the demo? Because the songs on the demo that we liked was a song called Princess Mononoke. And my stomach dropped. I realized I'd given them the wrong CD.
I was just gonna say,
I'd given them some early demos that I just did as a joke for it was just a complete joke, and those were the songs that Polygram liked, not Underground Railroad.
Oh no.
So I made a quick exit from there, and my girlfriend, different girl, my girlfriend at the time, she said, that's now my wife, by the way. And she said, well, if those are the songs that the record label likes, maybe those are the songs that you need to develop.
Mm-hmm.
And so I said, okay. And I formed Lewis Ling and the Bombs. There we are.
Okay.
So it was all, the whole thing was just a reaction to a complete accident.
Nice. All right. So then a few questions first, and then going forward, basically, how were you producing? Like, so you had just moved to Paris. What was your setup? Like, did you have a studio setup? Like, had you set up a music studio when you got there? How were you producing this band?
No, I didn't have anything. I just, for the drums, I hired a real studio.
Okay.
So I just hired a studio. And again, it's a good story. I told the guy, yeah, you got to give me your studio. It's the best band in France. It's going to be amazing. You got to give me a good deal. So he gave me a really good deal for one day. And then we recorded all the drums in one day. And then we left the studio and he called me right back and said, well, you're coming tomorrow, aren't you? And I said, no, no, we finished it. We're out. We've done it. And he's like, I only gave you that price because I thought it was going to take a week. And I said, no, no, we're finished. Bye.
So, okay. Now, another question. You didn't happen to read KLF's The Manual, did you?
Yes, I did.
Because this sounds very much like that story.
Yes, I am a big follower of The Manual. When I write songs, when I produce songs for other people, I follow The Manual.
I like it. It's a fascinating. I just finally was able to find a copy, or thought to find a copy. It's one of those things where, like, I've been able to find things on the internet for years, and then all of a sudden I was like, oh, can't I just torrent it or something? You know, and I actually ended up finding somebody doing an audio version of it on YouTube, and I was able to listen to it as an audiobook.
And oh, that's great. Cool.
Yeah,
that's cool. It's almost a religious text.
It's pretty fascinating. I mean, it even still holds up, even though it's from the 90s. It still is there's some good stuff in here. Anyway, okay, exactly. So you did that. And then my next question is, how did you you recorded this demo. How did you get the ear of Polygram Records? How did you do that?
Well, the Parisian punk scene is quite a small scene. There's only like, back in those days, which was the early 2000s, if you're talking about rock music, mm-hmm. only a few hundred people. So I would go to the rock bars, and in the rock bars, a few of the people in the rock bars were A&R people for Polygram. So I just kind of like bumped into those guys. But
they were already hanging out in the area.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. You're in Paris. You have an advantage.
It's like it's the equivalent of LA and New York rolled into one.
Right. I'm thinking of it like there are no record producers in our town here. And it's like, oh yeah, because I'm in Madison.
Yeah, if you're in LA, you just go to any like music bar and you'd eventually bump into a record industry dude.
Okay. All right. That actually makes a lot more sense now. That's not as far of a leap for me to try and understand. Okay. Now, after that, you said, so then you formed Lewis Ling and the Bombs, but you had to find people. At this point, it was just you, wasn't it?
It was just me. And then I made a kind of pact because the songs came from random jokes that I'd been making with my girlfriend at the time, completely randomly. There was I wrote a song called Conspiracy, which is still like the fan favorite. Mm-hmm. And we wrote that song just as a joke because we were watching YouTube, and we discovered that YouTube was just full of conspiracies, like lizard peoples and stuff like that. It was amazing. I suppose it's even more amazing now. But there was some really far out conspiracies on YouTube. And
now those conspiracies have sponsorships.
Yeah.
Now, hey, I'm going to tell you this conspiracy theory, but remember, check out our sponsor.
Now it's like this crazy conspiracy theory sponsored by Elon Musk or whatever. Mm-hmm. But back in those days, it was underground, man.
Yeah.
It was underground. You didn't have billionaire support in it. Right. It was just like some dude like with a cardboard cut out of a lizard person saying, you know, it was crazy. So I did that. And then I said to myself, everything in this band is going to be random. So it's just going to be random stuff. So to make the band, I called up a great guitarist that I knew. And I said, hey, can you give me the number of your brother? So he gave me the number of his brother. And I called him and I said, hey, dude, you got to play guitar in my band. And he said, I can't play guitar. And I said, I don't care because your brother plays a mean guitar. So I'm sure you're going to play guitar. So and he said, I don't play guitar and I don't want to be in your band. And I said, okay, we're practicing at this time in this place. And he came.
Did he even have a guitar? I mean, how does this work? I can call up any random person and go, you're my guitarist.
Yeah. He borrowed a guitar and he was terrible. He really, really was bad. But he looked cool. And
is that why you chose him?
Yeah.
Okay. All right.
He brought with him a kind of drummer, and that's basically how everybody was recruited in the band. It was just kind of random.
So the guitarist who didn't play guitar said, "I brought a drummer, which it's like bonus for you, less work to do."
Yeah, and... exactly.
Okay.
Very early on, there was a girl that is still the coolest girl in the world. That is Juliet, I wanted her to be in my band. She's half Japanese, half French, and she was just doing backing vocals. But every concert we did, because we did concerts straight away, we didn't practice at all. We just played concerts.
Like the Germs.
Yeah, we didn't practice. We didn't practice.
Like the stage was your practice.
Exactly, because I had enough experience in bands to already know that practicing is just a waste of money. It's just a waste of time. No one cares. but we just, we're actually playing gigs is like being paid to practice. So that's good.
That's a good point. I like that.
Much better. Yeah, much better. And also the audience really like can gives them a chance to actually like you. When they see that you're rubbish, they actually like you. I don't know what, if you go and see a band and they just like terrible, you instantly kind of like them. So I don't know about that, but okay.
I see where you're getting at.
Yeah. I mean, but when we were on stage, we jumped around in all directions. It was chaos, total chaos. Mm-hmm. And we always put Juliet in the middle as if she was the lead singer. But at that time she had like three things to say in the whole set. But we always put her in the middle. And eventually she kind of turned to me. She said, "Why are you putting me in the middle?" And I said, cause you're the lead singer. And she said, "Am I?" And I said, "Yes." And then she became the lead singer. And now most of the songs, she sings the lead on most of them.
Okay. Now, what would, if Juliet didn't know that they were the lead singer, what was Juliet doing up to that point?
She was just doing a couple of oohs and ahs in the band.
Okay. And the rest of you, were you chanting or just playing? Like what? I'm just trying to picture this whole process in my head.
It was kind of chaotic, but I'd already had quite a lot of experience with like songwriting by that point.
Okay.
Even though it was at the beginning of the band, so I'd written pretty basic songs that were catchy and very memorable. So I knew that you couldn't go wrong, mm-hmm. And around them the things got a bit crazy, especially sometimes with the structures went completely nuts because you're just on stage and you're going at like maximum speed you can,
yeah,
and you can't slow down to think, so things go out of control. But basically it all came together, and the Parisian punks grew to love us, so that was cool. It was very nice.
Okay. How often were you doing these shows even when you were just starting out? Like how often were you playing?
About once a week.
Okay.
We would play often in illegal squats around Paris because there was quite a lot. There was quite a lot of squats back in those days. It was really cool. These squat concerts were like an open, there's no rules. Like literally no rules. So artistically and what you did with yourself mm-hmm. with yourself, so there was a lot of craziness, but it was really cool, very a good place to develop an artistic voice. It was very good.
Yeah, and you've really kept that up. I mean, I am just so impressed by the amount of shows that you play, even today. Like whenever I see you online, it's like pictures of here we are, we just played here, or we're gonna play here. You just did something recently that was in, what'd you say, it was in like an old police bunker something like that. What was that?
That's true. We played in a squat that was an old gendarmerie. Gendarmerie is a kind of military police.
Okay.
So it's an old military police place, and the squatters, they even kept the drunk tank, and mm-hmm. the drunk tank is incredible. So we went in the drunk tank. It was like the scariest place, very, very freaky. But we, and they just kind of set up a nightclub in the basement. And it was, the basement was actually mud. There's no concrete.
It was a mud floor.
We thought it was going to be, cause it's pretty weird. So we thought there was going to be like four people, but there was packed. It was packed out, and people were bouncing off the walls, and there was like crowd surfing and stuff.
Okay.
And literally the mud turned into a kind of like mist or something. It was like everywhere. Everybody was covered in it at the end of the night.
Okay.
It's kind of cool. Kind of cool.
And now, because of the amount of touring you do and just how impressive the shows and places you play are, I'm curious as to how are you doing this? How are you booking these shows? I mean, booking shows for me is a nightmare. How do you go about doing so many shows and playing out and finding places to play?
That is, you're going to be disappointed with the answer. Because the answer is we just don't try. We actually refuse half of the shows that we're offered. But we have a reputation of accepting enough that people still offer. For example, we were offered a show. The next show we're going to play is our Christmas show at a bar called the Balto, which is a bar nobody knows of. And we accepted it because we didn't have anything else on. We regret it now because they're apparently there's police problems and there's risks of police being called during the show and stuff. So okay. I kind of regret accepting this gig. But we accept lots, but we refuse lots as well. And that's just, we've been around for 16 years now.
Yeah.
So we've kind of built up enough momentum.
And you've probably got a good list of people to reach out to if you're setting something up. Because you're calling it a world tour right now, aren't you?
When the last time we went to Germany, we called it a world tour.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
But it was just France and Germany, really.
Okay.
We have played Belgium, Holland, Britain, and that's all. That's our world tour.
All right.
We booked a tour in Japan, but we didn't go because it was too expensive.
Yeah.
We were invited to play the festival in the Zapatistas with the Zapatista rebellion. But we didn't go because it was too expensive as well.
Okay.
Now, but that would have been cool.
Totally. And
because Marcos was a fan of the band. He actually played us on his radio show.
Oh, they asked you to go there, is what you're saying.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, yeah.
See, that's the thing, is people are asking you to go places. And me, it's like, I have to call people up and they're like, let me get back to you. And maybe you hear back. And if you don't, they're like, we don't have a date, or we can give you a day on, like, you know, a Monday or something like that. Which that's fine. And we've done that, but still it's like, I feel like it's hard to find people to go do things to the point where we don't even play out of town. Really.
It was cheating. We cheated really because, for example, with the Zapatistas, we did a song called Zapatista where the chorus is Ya Basta, which is what the Zapatistas say. And the entire lyrics were English translations of poetry that Marcos has said in his manifestos.
Yeah.
So it was like a sure thing.
Right.
That the people in the chapas were going to like that song. It's punk. It's talking about them. It's in English. And the English that it's in is ripping off exactly what they like. So it's kind of cheating. You know, smart.
I mean, I wouldn't call it cheating. It's actually pretty strategic.
Yeah, it's strategic, but also we actually genuinely do love. We genuinely do love these people as well. We love them. So it comes from a genuine place, but it was just cheat, like pure cheating.
Okay. And the album you put out recently, which was in 2021, wasn't it?
Yeah, 2021, yeah.
So how did you go about making that album? Did you also book out some studio time for that? Are you self-producing now? Like, how are you making your albums these days?
Now we are the luckiest band in the world. Well, it's not exactly luck. We built our own studio.
Oh, you did?
We have our own studio, and it's awesome. It took me 6 months of work.
Now, when you say built, do you mean you found a place and then made a studio in it? Or are you saying you physically put up the walls?
I put up the walls. I rented a warehouse, 100-meter-square warehouse, and I built the walls and the floors and the ceilings, everything inside. Wow. And it was a bit of work. It took us 6 months, but now we have like a top tier commercial recording studio, so that's pretty cool.
I want to say 6 months is actually really fast.
Exactly. Now looking back at it, now I'm going, wow, because I do know like commercial recording studios, mm-hmm. that took 10 times more money to build and 2 or 3 times more time with huge teams of people. And so now looking back at it, I'm like, oh yeah, we did well.
Where is this place?
Just in Pantin, which is about 2 minutes outside of Paris. You can't.
Okay. So it's not like in your backyard or anything like that is what you're saying.
What? Sorry.
It's not like in your backyard or anything. You're saying you went somewhere and built it.
Yeah. Yeah. It's in a commercial area with lots of other studios. So it's in a prime spot.
Okay. That's impressive. I like that. So how long did the album take to make then?
Well, that's interesting because after Favela Ninja, which was the album before, we had vowed as a group never to make an album again. Because Favela Ninja took us 3 years to make.
Oh yeah, I could see that.
Then. And we lost a drummer during the making of it. The band nearly split up a few times. It was tough. It was really tough to make Favela Ninja. So we kind of like made a pact not to make any albums ever again. So when we made, what's the name of the album? Disruption Detected. Mm-hmm. Checking System, Disruption Detected. When we made that record, we thought we were making an EP. That's what we thought we were doing. Mm. We thought we were making a single, an EP. It was only Mike from Block Sonic that realized it could be an album, really. For us, it was just an EP.
Well, how did he realize it as more? An EP is like we have four songs or whatever. How did it become all the songs that they are?
Well, it was a surprise to everybody. We put a call out on Block Sonic for remixes.
Mm.
And normally those kind of things just get like a couple of replies.
Yeah.
But we got 18 remixes back.
Yeah, because you even made EPs out of those.
Exactly. So we made a ton of EPs out of just the remixes that we got from people.
Yeah.
So it was really good. So we were able to make a kind of whole, not just an album, but a whole release schedule with lots of singles.
Nice. It's funny. I actually had talked to Mike about doing that. I haven't heard back from him yet, but I reached out and then I saw that you had done that. And I was like, oh, that's kind of kismet. I was like, okay, so he is interested in doing that. And also the fact that we're more of like a lo-fi rock band. And I was like, is anybody going to want to remix that? And I'm like, oh, but you're like a fast punk band. So they were able to remix that. So, you know, maybe it can be done.
Anything's,
you know,
possible. I mean, a lot of these remixes, you can hear the limit of what they were able to do, because mm-hmm. you can hear it's out of time and that it's pushing the limit of what Ableton Live or whatever
right
program they're using can actually handle.
Okay. You know? Were you sending them stems or were they just doing it off of the source material? Like how were they making those remixes?
Some of them took the stems, which were made available by Mike on his website, and some of them specifically a kind of like dyslexic guy who does kind of like experimental music, he took the whole thing and just like chopped it up.
Okay.
Just the two-track master, instead of the stems, he just chopped it up into a million bits and made a kind of destructured version, but most people took the stems, I think.
Okay. And that's what I was wondering, is if you were offering the stems, where were you putting them? So you just exported those and gave them to Mike, and Mike put them on the Block Sonic.
We owe a lot to Mike, because really he was kind of like the visionary of all that side. Because we didn't really see much in the project, except that it was like a, a glorified EP. We didn't realize that it had the potential to be anything else, really.
Yeah.
He's the one that saw the potential in it more than us.
Okay. And then for the band, you release your stuff on Bandcamp, but do you, I mean, I know you don't have a website. Do you want a website? Like, how come you don't have a website?
We've done a few websites over the years, but they've always like gone out of, I think we have some websites somewhere because I don't think they disappear off the net, but nobody ever went to them. So we kind of just like forgot about them and just moved on. Life's too busy. You know, we get like just for Lewis Ling, I get tons of emails per week, to deal with. None of us, poor thing. Yeah, to deal with it.
All these people reaching out to you, liking your music.
yeah, exactly. Exactly. It's a good, honestly, it's a good, we have good times,
Yeah. And so now that you've released that album and you've got these remixes, I mean, what do you have in the works right now? Are you back to, we're never going to make an album again?
Yes, we are back.
Because that sparks an entire album and then people following you and you putting out remixes, right?
No, we just finished an EP.
Oh, you did?
So that's it. It's done. And I've actually sent it to Bloxonic and we're sorting out a release date. So it's
done. Tell me about the album.
The EP.
Yeah, the EP. No, sorry, the EP.
No albums, man. No albums ever again. The EP is three songs. A Japanese song.
Okay.
That is the first song to be written by our drummer, and obviously Juliet, the singer. So I didn't have a hand in it at all. It was entirely the drummer and the singer doing their thing. So I'm very proud of them. So that's finally, I'm free. I don't need to write songs anymore. And then the other one is They Stole the Rave, which is something that I always wanted to do. I always wanted to do a song, kind of like a rave rock song.
Really?
And it's really something I'm really happy with. So that's cool.
Okay.
I'm really happy with how that turned out. It's kind of like how I always imagined what a rave would sound like if it was with guitars. So that's cool.
Okay.
And it was written about a real thing that happened during the COVID. Because during COVID, the police in the north of France, northwest of France, they threw this boy in the river and he drowned. And then they pretended that they didn't do it for months. They pretended they didn't do it. And then they eventually found his body. And then the police came clean and said they did it. And then the kids of the area decided to organize a rave as a kind of like a send off for the kids.
Okay. I was trying to figure out how a rave fits into this. Okay. That makes sense then.
Yeah. So they organized a big rave and, well, it was during COVID, so I kind of see why this rave was forbidden. Mm-hmm. But the police turned up with hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of vans.
Really?
And they were really angry. And of course, the ravers filmed everything because it's the 2000s now.
Right.
But the police were not really understanding that they were all being live filmed. So I was watching Facebook Live while this was happening. Mm-hmm. And what was amazing, what was so poetic, is that police were beating people, but what was incredibly poetic is that the police were also beating the Technics 1210s and the subwoofers and the speakers, like with their truncheons. Mm. And they even had knives as well. They were stabbing the speakers.
Okay.
And some of the police were actually screaming with anger whilst they were stabbing speakers. It was an incredible bit of film. You know, and some of them were like, they were stamping on like record players and things like that.
Yeah.
And they were like, and they were shouting while they were doing it. So I suppose they were affected by COVID as well in some way.
Right.
But you could tell that they were not sane. They were not sane at all. So there's a kind of like madness that was gripping society at that time. Mm-hmm. in COVID, And that's perfect for a song, really. Kind of like this kind of madness of the generation, like the Police completely losing it. And also, obviously, people raving. I'm not exactly in their best, all there either. Mm-hmm. So it's kind of a great thing for a song. There we are.
When do you think this EP is going to be released?
Our friends at Bloxonic, we were thinking about April.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right. Yeah. I didn't know you had something in the works. That's really cool. And then.
Yeah.
Exactly. And what kind of stuff do you have coming up otherwise, like shows or projects or things that you're doing? What other things do you have coming up that you'd like to mention?
I did a solo record actually.
Oh.
That I'm going to release as soon as possible. I'm looking for a band name for that, for the band actually. That's why I haven't done the front cover yet.
You've made an entire album, but you haven't thought of what you're going to call it yet?
Not an album.
No, I'm sorry.
Six song EP. Six songs.
You said record, so I assumed it was an album.
Yeah, it's six songs of hardcore punk this time. So just purely hardcore.
Yeah.
So because I was feeling angry, I think.
Okay.
I've been angry this last month. So yeah, that's exciting. That's an exciting thing because I've never done a solo project before. Because being the main songwriter in a band, there's no need to do a solo project.
Right.
You don't actually feel this like backed up creatively because you're like the main songwriter. Mm-hmm. And now the drummer and my singer have kind of taken over. I kind of like thought it was a good opportunity for me to express a darker side.
A darker side, because over the years you haven't been fulfilled with your dark side yet, and now you're just really getting down there.
Exactly. Well, because the concept of Louis Ling and Louis Ling and the Bombs is always it was always pop music.
Yeah.
But then I realized that that in France there was no pop music written for anarchist people, and there was a lot of anarchist people in France. So I put a lot of anarchist politics into the music, and that immediately gave us an audience, which was very nice because a lot of anarchist music was very based around very fast hardcore and noise core and things like that. But there hadn't been in France, there hadn't been up to that point much like really poppy music.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And then if people want to listen to you, where would you suggest that they should go listen to you?
Well, they can go to Bloxonic, obviously. Mm-hmm. That's good. But our favorite website is Bandcamp And it's only recently that I don't like Bandcamp anymore because they're union busters. I didn't know that until very recently. The new company that just bought them are union busters, but we love Bandcamp. We love Bandcamp.
So go to Louis Ling and the Bombs on Bandcamp.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. Although now I feel a bit dirty because, now I know that the cut that is going to Bandcamp is going to a bunch of union busters, man. Who would have thought it? I never would have. That's terrible.
Well, I want to thank you for talking with me today because I am not a union buster and I enjoyed talking with you today.
No, that's good. don't bust unions, dudes.
And thanks. It's been great talking with you.
It's been a pleasure. Pew, pew.